We'll take turns.
Did we really? How was it? No, it had paused and this was.
Well, I guess Tim would with Dave.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
And just so you know, for in the future for personnel matters, both Jamie and Helen now in the office are doing employment, and Helen is going to be the one that's servicing Mount Regional.
Okay. Sounds good. Thanks. Who had that motion?
That was Karen.
I did the
motion. Ian second. And then is the microphone on?
We're back recording now, so we need to just update the situation with the decision on the Ascent Hotel. I can go ahead and do that. So the recorder was not on. The recorder was not on for the Ascent Hotel discussion. We talked through the concept of master metering the Ascent Hotel since it's going to function as a hotel. Since it is a condominium. How do I explain this? The hotel is going to function as a hotel. There's a condominium plat since each room is individually owned. Per our rules and regs, condominiums need to be individually metered. Given the fact that this is going to function as a hotel and be plumbed as a hotel, the board has approved an individual master meter for this case.
It was approved by motion made by Karen, seconded and voted unanimously by the board.
Well, did we have a motion to go with the personnel session? We did.
Yes.
Okay, and it was
Karen.
Karen.
And seconded by Ian.
Thank you.
And we had a motion from out made by Karen, seconded by Ian. Okay, consent agenda. Anybody have any questions or comments on meeting minutes, check register, approval of PO, or any other?
Oh, can I just ask on the check register? So what's the 140 some thousand going to Paul Corporation? It just says treatment plan?
Yeah, membranes or carbon?
Membranes.
So we changed out the membranes on, I think we mentioned it in our financial summary, and the carbon, and both those invoices came in this last time.
That was about all I had.
Yeah, so oh, carbon was about 70.
And why do we need $553 worth of stethoscopes?
Thank you, that was mine.
Okay, so.
Chris or Brett, you want to take that?
Yeah, that was a poor description choice.
Why? Well, the carbon of stethoscopes.
But we should have more description, like for the pipes. So not for
the
people.
They do stethoscope in leaks.
So as the seasonal guys are going out installing meters, we're having them listen on the setters we bought on a whole lot.
Yeah. Well, I assumed it was something like that. It was
an unusual item.
And it was in the same that first aid kit, so.
Do we have some employees we were concerned about?
I always go and check the heart machine every morning, make sure it doesn't get.
What's happening is we're changing out the older areas, and some of the set the corp stops are leaking on those older areas. So when they pull the meter out, they actually can hear from that point to the main shutoff. So it's a helpful tool. We had a huge leak in some apart with that just recently that we found, and so it's a helpful tool.
Okay, well, thank you.
I had
you.
A question on just a Casella support trading software. What was that?
Casella's our billing software and also our
general ledger accounting, everything.
Okay. So that's a monthly bill, probably for
24.
All the support services and updating to the software and stuff like that.
That's we pay for that in part because it's a hosted cloud solution for us. So it's an ongoing thing. They do the updates, they do our data backups and all that stuff. We don't.
That's okay. I just think the definition of support trading software is different.
Yeah.
There was the charge in April for the Summit Park St. Moritz sewer. Did we impact their sewer and need to do engineering on that? Or
that sewer?
was it?
Or is that just a bill for the Innsbruck pump station?
That was an architectural firm or something. I can't remember.
It was a follow-up. It might be part of this on our phase six.
Well, do you remember how much it was?
Mm-hmm. Which month it was?
It was April. And it's towards the front end.
And it was the Snyderville, you said?
Or no, it just said Summit. It just said Summit Park, St. Moritz Sewer. That was the only description. It's 22102 on 430 Alliance Engineering.
Oh, that's for the Summit Park project. It's 2% sewer, but we're replacing the water line on the same grid.
Okay.
So probably
we do
the pipes up there.
Alliance does the design on all the Summit Park upgrade work through Summit County.
So it's not sewer district. It's not true term of sewer. It's
no.
Just with our pump station.
No, they're replacing the sewer line, right?
And sewer and water.
And the water doing
all
the
water.
It's a combined project with the county, so we're the Madison.
So it just has that label, but it's...
Yeah,
okay. And then the tailgate collision charge in May, is that an accident? Like one of our vehicles got hit or...
Yeah,
someone
backed
back
into
him.
Some... He backed into the holes.
Oh, okay. Is that why there's a drone screen that month too? Yeah.
Yep, you get both. You do something, you get.
I thought that was our policy. And then the Institute of Health, or Institute for Environmental Health water testing charge. Which test is that? I've seen that in a couple of monthlies.
Institute for Environmental
Health. That's the new one that was sending to Julie, California.
It's like $350.
That's all the crypto testing we have to send out of the state.
Okay,
that's what those charges are.
Yeah, and typically we send everything to Chemtech, so.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Fit for me.
Any other questions? Have a motion to approve the consent agenda?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Consent agenda is approved. Item 6, questions on departmental updates.
Can I ask Scott about the Snowberry easement?
Absolutely. So, one of the waterline projects we had scheduled for 2019 is to run a water main from the Red Hawk water system down into the Glen Wild system to improve the pressure on the top of Snowberry Street. Cul-de-sac at the top of Glen Wild that has low pressure that we're trying to improve both for fire protection and for the level of service of the homes. We, upon initial review of all easement paperwork, we believed that we had the right to go ahead and do that project. As we looked at it more closely, it's probably been, a couple months ago or so. We realized that we needed an easement from the owner of Lot 17 up in Red Hawk. I have reached out to that homeowner. Essentially, our preferred approach is to connect just outside of the pump station, get a small easement to run a water line about 100 feet and get out of their property back into Glen Wild. We already have a footprint on the property. They've responded and said, no, they're not interested. So I have responded again into backup. I started with an email, voicemails. We ended up sending a certified letter, and we finally got a response, and the answer was no. That no came in early this week, Monday or Tuesday. I responded to her again this week and approached her about a second alignment. There's a utility road that runs between Glen Wild and Red Hawk. again, there are no easements on this road for utilities or the fire department or anybody else.
How did that happen?
All I can guess is that when that road was put in and platted, the plat wasn't sent to the service providers for comment. But I don't have any idea how that happened.
Yeah. So, Scott, when you talk about the road up there, are you talking about from the gate down into Glenwild? Or
yes.
Are you talking about from Red Hawk to the gate?
Well, there's a gate on each end. And
even the gated stretch is our area of interest. You know, from the Red Hawk gate to the Glenwild gate, there are no easements on that.
Because from the gate back into Red Hawk, like towards Red Hawk Trail, up through Red Hawk Fort, that was a granted fire access by the original developer of Glenwild. It was a granted access from Red Hawk to the original developer of Glenwild, way back before it was Glenwild, Black Hawk Development Corporation or something.
When you read that, though, part of it is that it's a blanket, because there's no description for it. It says to be determined at a later date until it's otherwise granted. And when they created the other plats and recorded the plats, the access became all within the roads of Glenwild and the preserve and so forth to get through to Red Hawk. There's a vacation, essentially, if you will, of the document you're talking about, where they say because these other things have happened, we abandon this. So there's another piece to that, because if it's an original one, there is not a description of where this lies. You know, there's no physical legal description.
Okay, because
I went through every easement document recorded against Red Hawk and Glenwild to try and figure out a way to get that, and it's not there.
That's interesting, because it was required by the county, because at the time Black Hawk needed two entrances right for fire. It was Black Hawk's obligation to maintain all those roads. And I guess somewhere along the line they abandoned it when they got the rest of the Glenwild access points.
So what is interesting is the Glenwild boundary falls approximately right here. So everything to the right is Glenwild, everything to the left is the Red Hawk stuff, which precedes the Glenwild stuff. Glenwild, this is actually granted as a utility and access easement to this point.
I misspoke on that.
Yes, yeah, it's from here to this cul-de-sac.
Right.
The right-of-way ends right here at the cul-de-sac. So technically, this is private drive all the way. And then from here, this is no man's land.
Okay, the gate is
right there.
Right there by the driveway.
Yep.
Right.
And then the Glenmont gate's way up.
And so where do you need easement?
So we have two alignment choices. We have to connect down here, run a water main up and follow in. So either
I've got where's the property line.
Essentially, just this, right? Just this area here, we would need an easement to connect just outside of the pump station and get back into the Glenwild subdivision. Or, our other option is if the subdivision boundaries here, we need an easement from here to connect to the main here at the end of the driveway.
So in Red Hawk, we have an existing easement over all of our permanences.
Yeah.
So all we have to do is get to that point, and we're okay.
And lot 17 is that house right there?
That house right there.
And they won't.
Then that road is on their property.
Correct.
And their property being like in the road.
Yeah, they own the road.
So let me.
Let me rephrase that.
Do you want to bring
it? Yeah, I'm going to
bring it.
since announced.
Well, here's the deal. So that easement was, you know, or that deal was cut long before the Facentos built there.
Yeah.
And was, oh, okay, here we go.
So can you just explain the two alignments, Chris, one more time?
Yeah, so this red line, this is now 90 from how we were. So Glen Wild is to the south and Red Hawk is to the north. So this is the subdivision boundary. So what we originally were talking about is from the back of our building, we need to be able, and the existing water line comes right through here.
Yep. Oh, it does.
Yeah, so the existing water line leaves the asphalt, and maybe back closer to the driveway, but somewhere in this vicinity, and it comes right. There's some valves and some other air vat kind of stuff through this area, and it comes down into the booster station. So what we're talking about is being able to tie into here and come around and back. That's the first option. That was the one that Scott originally proposed to them.
So just that little piece.
Yeah, jump back to the pump station,
water line easement.
And it's just excavated, right?
And yeah, excavated, revegetated,
nothing about that. Just, you know, underground water line. And then the other option is to come from here, go up the road, and then to here to where we tie into the other one.
Which is more expensive, I'm guessing.
Significantly.
Yeah. How much more? I think it's 400 feet of line.
Yeah, assuming $100 bucks a foot, it's $40,000.
But you have the right to go up that road.
No. We would still need me
from them.
Yeah. And probably technically this person as well.
I think that road lies entirely within Lot 17. I could be wrong. We did some research on this in the HOA.
Yeah, it could, without a survey, it's hard to know. But that's another additional cost that's going to be required as a survey.
And again, I still can't believe that there isn't an easement on both sides of the property.
So here's another thing. That Red Hawk does not have your typical utility easement on either side of the property line. There's no flat.
We tried to trace that approach, too, by cross-country and tracing the property line.
Yeah, everybody owns to the center of the road. And there's only specific. But you have a general easement. So you can say there's no utility easement on either side of the road, but you have an easement to pretty much go wherever you want to.
It only protects that which has already been constructed. So we have to do any future improvements, we don't have any easements.
So we don't really have an easement where we have the station already. It's just
We do.
Because it was existing
at the time. Yeah. So if that's kind of the other part of the rub with this one is that the Red Hawk, the Ridge Red Hawk was platted in 97, give or take. And then in 2007, the easement was recorded. So when Mount Regional had taken over everything, there's an easement that the developer granted that's a blanket easement over everything, but it's specifically worded so that it's existing infrastructure that's going to preclude anything new.
I mean, that's about as far away from their house as you can get. It's on the edge of their property.
Say it first.
I mean, we can condemn it.
Yeah, we can condemn it.
So, you know, that's
okay. Yeah, that works so well for
that. Well, that would take a little time to do. We'd have to go out and go through the process of getting appraisals and so forth. And we can do that if that's what we have to do. I think that's, we generally don't like to do eminent domain.
So I sent the initial email 3 weeks ago. So over the past 3 weeks, it's been email, I sent the email, I left two voicemails. We sent the certified letter last week. They responded early this week. I responded back and said, what about the road alignment? You know, what can we do to come to terms on this? And I sent them them another email this afternoon as a follow-up to ask them, have you had a chance to look at my second request? That's where we're at.
And also another piece of back history on this one, we had a radio tower on their site, on their lot. It had been there
This was the one with the two radio towers?
No, this was from the beginning. We had a very large, what would you say, 60-foot tower, 50-foot tower there. I mean, it was a sizable triangular tower. It had been there for a long time. They bought the lot, and somewhere along the line, there was the request for us to take it down. And we were doing a SCADA upgrade at the time, so we needed that site to be able to get signal out. So it took us a while to get down, and in conjunction with the SCADA upgrades we were doing at the time. So there may be some bad blood left over from that because it took us longer than they had wanted. Because they wanted it done before their house was done, which it was, but there was some angst about that.
So if we do the eminent domain route, they'll get a certain financial incentive or some sort of payment. But right now we're just asking for them to agree to the easement without any financial incentive.
I recognize that an easement is a property right. I think it would only be fair to offer compensation based on the appraised value of that property right. We're not trying to do a land grab. You know, it's just quite simply, you know, even come to the table to work with us so we can get to an agreement. That is not.
So the no is we don't even want to talk about it.
Yeah, the no I got was not interested.
Got it.
So even if the money was involved, the no was not interested. Or did it not?
Because when you get an appraisal for that easement, you get like $5,000,
no.
$10,000, it's not going to come out. So.
Not to move the needle for them.
No, you can always. I would have you sit down with Helen Strong in her office. I just had her do a condemnation for the North Summit Fire District. The rules of eminent domain are always changing. I would just have you guys sit down and go through what the process would be. I would imagine, because there are official steps in the process and various letters that go out that have legal consequences that would, maybe wake up the property owner as to they're prepared to condemn it. Maybe we should talk about it. Because ultimately, if we go through that process, and it takes time to do that, but if we go through that process, we get an appraisal done, and in the end, they're not willing, we file a condemnation action here in court. I don't know if these guys are full-time residents or part-time residents.
Part-time.
But they're going to have to they'd have to come out here and hire an attorney, go to court, try to fight it if they wanted to. We get an order of immediate occupancy within the first 30 days because the water line is public use. And the only thing left to fight about would be the appraisal. Is it worth it for them? I guess if they have lots of money and they want to fight stuff, they can.
What's the necessity again for this?
Pressure. Firefighting pressure.
Right now you have a system in place that doesn't have that connection, so is it non-compliant?
Kristen, you go back to that?
Yes, these lots. So this is one of these developer gifts that we got. The as-built drawings show the system ending here. And the reason the system ended there was because that's the last point that water pressure meets Division of Drinking Water requirements. Somewhere along the lines, when the system was put in, the developer or somebody else decided to run the water line to the end of the road. The water line in that cul-de-sac does not have pressures that are approved for DDW requirements. I became aware of this situation about a year ago, and I had the fire department come up and do a flow test of a hydrant in that cul-de-sac. And their response was, this isn't adequate. So it was at that time that I promised the fire department that this year we'll get this
situation corrected going through this this approach.
And was that the time why I'm laughing? I had a conversation today with Mike Adams at the fire department.
He is the gentleman we met.
About sprinklers and fire response up in our area there. And he told me if we had a wildfire up there, there's no way that they'd have enough pressure with everybody's sprinklers going off and trying to draw water off the system. They would, they'd run out of water, they wouldn't have enough water to fight a fire. So it was kind of like, okay, so you have all these requirements for me to have sprinklers, but if my sprinklers go off, you don't have enough pressure to fight the fire. He said, yeah, the only reason for your sprinklers is give you 10 minutes to get out. That's
all,
the only reason.
That's all there's
but he said, otherwise your house is going to burn to the ground.
The only reason I was asking is that you can't generally go into condemnation unless you can prove that there's a need, right? And then you have to go in there and see that there's no viable alternative.
Right.
So the need
but
is...
But the fire department should have lived the need.
The need is we need to remedy a compliance issue.
But what it basically boils down to is that we're all spending a lot of time and energy for something that has no practical value. That's the way I look at it.
The fire sprinklers?
Well, there's not enough, you know, I mean, there won't, there's a fire that hits that house and much it's indigenous to that house, okay? There's not going to be enough water in there.
This is there's also somebody building right here. They are hooking on per the as-built at the last connection based on the original system design.
Scott, does that house have adequate pressure now?
That upper one?
Yeah.
No.
No.
So they call them complain about lack of pressure?
No, they have a booster pump in their house.
Oh.
Okay.
Aren't those illegal?
They are.
My last meeting.
Would the house that's being built right now take pressure? Well, I guess it wouldn't matter since they have a booster station, but would it take pressure away from that other house? Would it have adequate pressure, I guess?
This house?
Yeah.
From my perspective, we're meeting the division's requirements.
Okay.
That's until they build their house. This gentleman has been in and talked about how many beds he wants in his shower, and he's aware of the low pressure situation up there, and is wondering when it's going to be fixed.
What kind of pressure are we getting?
This last point of connection here is about 25 psi to the road. 20 is the requirement, and they're down a few feet to the main level, so 30 at best at the main level. It's lower than that in the cul-de-sac.
Well, I mean, sounds to me like you don't have a whole hell of a lot of choice, but tell them, you know, we're sorry, we don't really want to do this, but, you know, we have to meet fire department code for the Glenwild people, and, you know, if you don't agree, we're going to have to condemn them. Do you have any other suggestions?
The actual appraised value may be nothing. Where you've already got, it's already encumbered by a utility in the same spot. Usually they try to say that they've lost some use of the property. Well, they don't lose anything. They've already, there's already a pipe there. You just put another one next to it.
So after 10 of those things you get, like
the only other thing I can offer is I'd be happy to talk to the president of the HOA and see whether he'd be willing to talk to them, but there's nothing in it for us, right, so to speak, because it's all one mile. The interesting thing is that their road is their driveway and we pay to plow. The whole neighborhood pays to plow their driveways, or up to their driveway connection point.
I would argue that there is something in it for Redhawk.
Okay.
This image doesn't have a way to look at
twisted.
Yeah. If there was a wildfire, this is downhill, okay? This is all downhill. If there was a wildfire in this vicinity and blowing up the hill, I would sure like to have a hydrant over here that's got some pressure on it.
This fire moves up.
Even if there's no good.
At least you got the pressure there because that wire.
Well, it depends upon how extensive the fires are, right?
But they can get to it.
I mean, that's one of the approaches I've taken with this homeowner. I believe there is a benefit to them.
Well, you know who's uphill from that fire?
So I will.
I'm directly, I'm a little over this.
No. Is it worth taking that additional step that Bob proposed, having the head of the HOA talk to him?
I think any. I'm open to any ideas or support. My next step is on Monday. If I don't hear back on these two emails this week, I'll call them again. Like I said, they haven't been picking up my phone calls, but I'll keep trying.
But this is a long process, Dave, right? I mean, what's long, like 3 months, 4 months?
We're probably talking in order, if you went through the process to get an order of immediate occupancy, probably 6 months.
Cool. Okay. So it wouldn't even be in place for the fire season this year?
No.
That sucks. We might not even be able to get it in within the promised year.
Well, let me do this, Scott. I'll call the president of the HOA tonight. I don't know these people. When I was president of our HOA, I never saw them.
They're out of Vegas, right?
Yeah. And Patty is up to speed.
Yeah.
You know, she's been. You know, we've been talking with Patty about this probably since late last year. Said, hey, we want to do this. We started reviewing easements, yada, yada.
Patty's, she managed that.
Yep, Patty's anxious to get it done.
Well, yeah, she's in that enviable position. She's our person and Glenwild's person.
Yeah.
You know, their firm does a lot of work. She has had some contact with because we've had some issues about that road was supposed to be a fire access road, and the fire department said, we don't want it, we don't need it, you do that what you want. And we were supposed to be plowed and maintained by Glenwild, which they never did. And so the community agreed that we would continue to plow it on the theory that maybe we would need it at some point in time. Fire circumstance when we need to get out, but so they get kind of free ride and fly fairly lengthy.
Oh, yeah. Kind of cost of
it would be worth sharing some of Scott's positions with the head of the HOA just so they know kind of our stake for that to him.
Yep. All right, I will undertake to do that.
Thank you.
We'll
appreciate
report
it
back to you as quickly as I can.
Sounds good.
Any other questions on department budgets?
We really have that many delinquent people, Marty?
We talk about
Is that typical number? Or?
No, because it used to be like triple that or more.
Holy cow.
But since we do shutoffs, you know, after 90 days plus 90 days, people are paying. It's typically most of them are vacant lots, you know, that there's no teeth, there's no incentive for them to pay, you know, so they end up.
Yeah, I noticed that quite a few of them are on the market.
Yes. But we are doing great. It used to be like in almost 200,000 in the past, and the county doesn't mind seeing it so bad now with 30 or so.
Let me go back on departmental things. Doug, did you have?
Yeah. We have a proposed project that we wanted to run by you. This project has been talked about for years. Just a little background, Mount Regional consumes about 10 million kilowatt hours a year of energy. So equal to about 1,000 homes per year. About 60% of that energy is used at Lost Canyon, just the one pump station. The rest is the next biggest one, is about a tenth of that energy is used at the water treatment plant. We pay about $70,000 a year, or a little bit more, for energy and power at the treatment plant. Summit County has had an initiative for several years. Dave's familiar with this, Scott, where they're trying to get all of the governments in Summit County, especially Western Summit County, on renewable sources of energy. And we don't have time to get into all of that, but they're working on proposals to try to use blue sky energy, which is solar and wind, on all the government facilities, and they're working on negotiating contracts to try to get that as cheap as possible. One of our most feasible solar project is at the treatment plant. We've always felt like the nice thing about the treatment plant is the cost is in energy. The demand power charge is relatively small compared to other pump stations. I mean, it's probably like 20% compared to half and half at some other pump stations. And that's because the plant just runs around the clock all the time. It's consuming energy. We've always had this idea So the treatment plant's a little over 800,000 kilowatt hours a year. Putting in enough solar on a net metering agreement with the power company to totally power the plant. And what you're seeing in blue, so on the right is the treatment plant, the building. This is the intake pond, the Lost Canyon Pumpson pond. We have thought about floating panels. That's about probably a little over an acre worth of panels on the pond, with a little bit on one side of the upper roof of the treatment plant. This is an expensive project. Our preliminary estimates, we've been working with a solar installer that the county's worked with on several projects. It'd be about $1.1 million. When word got out that we were looking at this, we've been working with Lisa Yoder, the county sustainability director, and this contractor. When word got out about this, the Blue Sky program perked up because they've never done a project like this in Utah. These are done in some other places. They're really more common in Japan and Europe, but there's some big ones back east. There's one in Colorado that's been in a couple of years at a pond that's higher elevation by above Steamboat Springs. There's a big one they're planning on in California. But Blue Sky, when they heard about this, they asked us to submit an application to get a grant funding for this. And so we turned in an application yesterday because we needed to get it in to get ahead of some other applications for about 65% to be funded through a grant. And there's a possibility. I mean, I've been very skeptical about this, getting money, but it sounds more and more like we could get it. I mean, it's not a for sure thing.
Yeah.
And then the remaining $400,000 would be on us, but now the state, we've been talking to the state energy office, and they might be able to come up with some more to help on that, either through grants or loans but the beauty of this is the payback is like 6 years, whereas if I didn't have the grant, it would be like 20 years.
6 years, at the full cost or where?
Our 400K. Yeah, we'd recover that in about 6 years.
Yeah.
So.
Because solar and storage is bad.
Yeah. And well, and this is not cheap, but the reason for years I toyed with this is because it creates some other, it helps us out on some other things.
on the pond, it reduces the sunlight by, you know, we're cutting probably half the sunlight off that pond. By cutting off the sunlight, you reduce algae growth in the pond, which is a big problem for us. I mean, we can't tell exactly how, but it won't make it worse, it'll make it better. Another issue is, as Karen knows, the wind blows up there like 90 miles an hour. It would reduce some of the erosion, the wave erosion that we get on the banks of the pond from just wind activity. It would help with the water temperature. It would probably be a little cooler. It would help. We wouldn't evaporate as much on the pond. And then another interesting thing is when you put solar panels over water like that, they're actually more efficient because they run cooler. One of the problems with solar panels, they get so hot, they lose a little bit of efficiency. Well, the pond keeps it cool, and you pick up a little bit more efficiency. So,
what's the dust depositing factor up there?
Probably not that much, just because of the wind. I mean, this is a.
And the way these, that's a good question. The way these floating arrays are, you can walk, it's almost like a plastic sidewalk. You can walk all the way across the array. So we even talked today about, you know, if we have to get out there a couple times a year and hose these things off, it's easy to do.
Okay. That's a real problem.
I mean, we factored in, you know, you cover these so much with snow, the pond freezes. These are a special type of float because the pond has to be able to go up and down. That's why they're not going to the bank. There's cables that suspend it out there, and it allows, we could drain the pond, and these would sit on the bottom of the pond.
So this is the small installation near Steamboat.
So you can see how you can walk right down between each. It's so like it's a big floating dock. This is a big one.
So what is the neighborhood care anything about that?
Well, the beauty of it is that it's at the very top of the hill, so it's not in anybody's view corridor. So
we believe we'd have to run it by promontory. This isn't a recreation.
Well, because they've never been cool about solar panels. That's the only thing I've
homes and stuff like that.
But like there are a couple homes, but again it's supposed to be something that you can't see from any place.
Well, you wouldn't see this from any place.
And you know, so I think it might, you know, just barely qualified.
The other thing is if you get Blue Sky funding, they want to make sure that you can take people up to see it. They like to show up.
Yeah.
And this is appealing because it's not on commercial buildings that are covered with solar panels, you can't see it. Well, this is one you could walk. I mean, we take a lot of people up to tour the plant.
Yeah.
You could see the solar panels and see the plant at the same time. And you have to put up kiosks that show, you know, screens that show the production. But, you know, in fact, the email I got today from someone in the state, they said, we might have some legislators that want to talk to you about this. I mean, it's just different is why it appeals to them. And if they find out something like this works well, then they will do it in other places. Sewer lagoons are a great application for this because you don't want some on a sewage lagoon either. And there's some big sewage lagoons in Utah, huge ones. So we're applying, it's a process, we would have to bid it if we get the funding, but I mean, we've tried to poke holes at this thing, and it seems to, like it might work.
We have some much more detailed information that we can put in the July packet. We just wanted to bring it up so you knew that we were working on it.
Yeah, I guess the question is the reliability of all this stuff.
Well, I mean, it's not like solar technology is brand new or anything.
So these aren't special?
No,
but you know, power panels or something.
Same panels you put on commercial.
Overheating, exploding.
Looks kind of the life cycle kind. cost of this? Are we now having, I have no idea on these kind of farms, whether you have to bring on an employee to maintain it.
I don't think counties hired anybody to maintain their, county's got some big ones. They've got the jail.
Yeah.
It's covered with panels.
So you can operate it just like the jacuzzi guy.
My initial reaction, Tim, was that it's just one more thing for us to maintain and take care of. But the more we've talked about it and the more we've looked into it, it seems like a pretty good deal if we can get all the funding.
I think it's super exciting. And again, I was always that person on the HOA, like, why can't we approve the solar panels? You know, so I think you'd have plenty of people in Promontory and, you know, certainly in Greater Park City that would think this is a super exciting project.
Well, it's great in this area, better than anywhere.
Yeah.
And you'll see things down the road, too. I mean, you look at the solar shingles they're starting to come out with.
Yeah.
I mean, they're expensive, but like something in Promontory, you could conceivably do that, no one would even know it. And so they get better. Even the panels look better than they used to.
Yeah.
So what are you going to, so the sun only shines, you know, X number of hours.
They factor all that in.
They factor snow cover.
You're not going to store energy, you're just going to dump it back to Rocky Mountain.
Rocky Mountain Power stores the energy. They become the battery with something like this. So
they've agreed to that?
Well, they have to.
How have you gone about, I mean,
they have to
anytime something's
with they're the ones loading the money.
I think that everybody
gets right into it
around about how cool it's going to be. And at some point, that kind of creates a little bit of bias where you want to make sure that you're only thinking about cool stuff and you're not thinking about the downside of it. Might be. When you're assessing that, are you just doing it among yourselves and trying to figure out, with all the experience you have with solar panels floating on stuff, what can go wrong? Are you reaching out to take a look at actually talking to people?
Oh, we plan on talking.
Okay.
We've been visiting some other installations and just seeing what we can learn from them.
I'd recommend you go to folks that have done this and then stopped doing it and find out why they stopped doing it. Because if it doesn't go right, I don't want to sound like I'm one. I'm not trying to kill it. I think it's a cool idea too, but if you get $1 million up there and it isn't working, now you got to explain why it didn't work. You know, and that could be kind of a bad thing too. So I just suggest you do a little bit of asking people that have done this, particularly people that have done it and abandoned it as an idea, and try to find out why they abandoned it.
Yeah, it also seems to me that it's very grant dependent without the grants.
Yes.
It's no grants.
It's nothing we would take on ourselves.
Yeah.
Okay, any other comments? No action required on this at this point, other than sort of keep at it?
Yep.
Okay. Do we do the certification of delinquent fees and charges? Do we need a motion on that?
This is something we do annually. And then what you see today isn't exactly perfectly current because we got payments in today.
Right.
But what we do is the day that we go to council, that's the day we go through everything and anything that's paid. You know, we take off the list and then whatever's certified is it's totally delinquent that day. So it's a work in progress. This isn't the snapshot in time this week. But that doesn't mean that's what we'll, it'll be less.
So, so the motion is to present to the county council for approval of collection activities on the point.
Correct.
Budget.
Yes.
So I have a motion to that effect.
I'll make a motion.
I'll second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Motion approved. That was Karen.
Thank you.
Okay. Lisa?
Yes. We have the executive summary for May. Let's just start at the top. We are currently $284,000 is our current net loss year to date, which is about $700,000 better than we had projected. through May. The positive variance is primarily related to higher retail water sales. We saw those higher usages in the early part of the year. So that directly correlates to the higher revenue we're seeing. And we also have higher interest earnings due to the higher cash balances than we had originally budgeted. We're also showing expenses are about $300,000 lower than we projected. And this can be just a timing difference due to when we're doing repairs and maintenance. We've had a little bit longer of a winter season, so it's been pushed off a little bit. That will change. I know Brian and his crew have been working a lot this last month, so the costs are coming in. That's going to go away a little bit. We go down to, and compared to last year, I guess we can look at that really quickly. We're a little bit below revenue compared to last year, and our, you know, $50,000 right on expenses. So we're pretty close to last year through May. That's going to change with the summer and wet weather we're having. Our cash balance was pretty standard from month to month, $300,000 increase. That's primarily due to debt reserves held by the trustee. Those are just our normal payments that we make monthly to make sure our balances are where they are. So when the principal payments are made, we did have significant principal and interest payments made in June. So balances will come down in that account. You'll see that next month. Other restricted cash also decreased significantly. That was due to the carbon and membranes at the treatment plant we talked about earlier. And we have a reserve account for that so that we don't see significant swings in our P&L when that happens. And then we go down to what we've had, 52 new water connections through May. That's we're pretty close on target. 47 has been our normal average. Last 4 years. The impact fee, total impact fees are, well, per connection are down. We've talked about that previously. We have Silver Creek coming on and they're using prepaid. So if you can go up a little bit, Chris. Yeah, you'll see our total collections for the 4 year average is down, and then our per average connection is down due to those prepaids being used. Promontory lot assessments. We are at 16, 14, the average, so we're right on target there. Water consumption, you'll see May is the top of that current month, significantly down, and I'll attribute a lot of that is to the promontory irrigation golf wasn't happening. That's a big user that time of the year. So we're at 79 acre feet this year. And 111 is typically our 4 year average, and significantly down from last year at 121 acre feet.
Do we make money on, so to speak, on the promontory irrigation water?
It's at a lower rate. Yeah, we're at a contracted rate with them, so that's also why you're going to see a little bit of difference. You say, well, our usage is down, but our revenues are up. So promontory's usage is down, but that doesn't affect the revenue side as much as the residential, the higher tiers. So I expect that'll pick up. I think we're seeing everybody turning on now. It is, you know, still raining, but I think everyone pretty much has their sprinkler systems running now. So
yeah, we just pulled a series in just the last couple weeks.
People are turning them on. So June will be a good indication. We'll probably still be a little bit down.
A little
lower. So Park City last month, was pretty much right on where they were last year. We know that's been increasing. Summit Water isn't taking any. Year to date, you can see we were up, now we're down compared to our 4 year average, 374 acre feet versus 400. Park City is at 700 acre feet. They were at 785 last year. They're around where they were last year. And Summit Water, I said, hasn't taken any, so that didn't change from last month. If you go down a little bit more, our capital budget tracking spreadsheet, we closed the annexation on Community Water. We have not closed the loan, so we are waiting for a conditional use permit and then we will get bids to do that work. So we have expended some to date. We talked about that last time. Most of that $36,000 is related to construction on line work we had done last summer. We're trying to, as we need to get things done at Community Water, meters changed out so we can collect data and usage information. We are expending some of Mountain Regional's money, but we expect all of that to be reimbursed to us when they close the loan, and we anticipate that being in October right now. And we have encumbered to date, the majority of that is the well that we went out to bid for, so that's what that is. We don't anticipate that happening until the loan closes either. So the other capital improvements we're working on, we just talked about the meter and the PO that you approved. We'll get the rest of those meters and that meter program continuing to move forward. Then the Silver Creek EPA line has been in.
Scroll
it's
down.
Done.
Right.
Yeah, it's done.
Scroll down a little bit.
Yeah. Pressure tested, back to you.
Yeah, I saw them blowing water out of it yesterday.
Mm-hmm. So we'll be seeing that the invoice for that shortly. It's not currently included in the tracking spreadsheet. We have one truck that we've purchased. We're waiting to complete the outfitting on it, and then the dump truck is on order right now. I think the new boiler has been purchased, but installed in the future. So that's it for the finance. Anybody have any questions?
Good work.
Thanks.
So what's the status of the reservoir with Snowmelt and all that kind of stuff?
The, say, Rockport Reservoir, the larger reservoirs, they're, in general, they're all nearly full. Some of them are spilling. So I think, Chris, weren't you saying today,
the Rockport was close to spilling?
The rock pool is first
filling. Yeah, so totally full.
Yeah, Jordanelle's full, Deer Creek's full.
I drove by Echo over the weekend, it was spilling.
Yeah, the flows have gone way up there. Mm-hmm. Like thousands of CFS.
So what, just out of curiosity, so when they start overflowing, what ultimately happens to that water? Flows down to somebody else captures?
Either that or the Great Salt Lake.
Great Salt Lake.
Date water.
The reservoirs usually, the lower ones fill first. They have higher priority water. Rockport's will be the last one to fill.
So if the summer continues wet, how are we going to be looking?
Lisa's crying and Brian's happy.
Well, I mean, this is what we were talking about. It's a totally different situation when we were sitting at our July meeting talking about water rates. But, you know, we have a wet year in there, and so our projections and our budget had a wet year and two warm years. We have a rate stabilization fund, which is over, you know, $1.2 million that if we needed to use, we have there. Our expenses are down. You know, we're down a little bit in personnel. We'll continue to monitor that as we see the revenue come in to make sure that
we're down on power.
So we'll continue to keep you updated. And the good thing is we closed Community Water. So we just added 500 customers base. And we're capturing irrigation over there as quickly as we can. So that will definitely help. June will be in.
Well, I'm just wondering about that water supply. Seriously. You have too much inventory, and it's coming, you know, it just keeps coming into the factory, and we're running out, you know, you're parking stuff in the parking lot.
If we're
parking it in Salt Lake, right?
If Weber Basin wants to offer it to us at a discounted rate, you know, we'd certainly take it. I think that's going to happen.
Water irrigation.
Yeah, but it's not like our storage can be fuller, right?
No.
And we normally just keep it already full, right?
What it ultimately means to us is the discussions we had about Weber Basin's drought response plan and, you know, giving us a haircut on water allocation, we don't have to worry about that. I mean, that's really what it means to us.
Yeah. And that was proposed to us.
Yeah.
Good. We can get on both sides.
Yeah, you lose money on either end.
But if we have a dry, hot fall,
that's right.
The fire danger goes in.
Which is the trend. The fall and the time of winter onsetting has been moving out. Wet and dry seasons in spring. So the overall trend is up.
We've had really good October water sales.
Yeah, that was the big difference last year, is that it just extended out, so we have that extra revenue last year. Yeah, expect the same.
Okay. For some reason, my computer will not fill up page 2 of the agenda.
All right, see? They were actually crazy. I've never seen that before.
All right, on to the policy revisions. Next on the agenda, item 9. There are very few changes since the last meeting. I made a couple changes to the administrative policy, largely just incorporating the board recommendations and then updating section 1.6 with just the adjustment to the job position title from Energy and Technology Director of Energy and Technology Management to the Chief Technical Officer. Also added the district engineer. On the rules and regs, we talked last meeting that I was going to reorganize that document to make it more, improve the flow. That's been done. And then the three changes listed there. There was a provision in there for customers to reduce their ERC count to 1. We got rid of that for 2 reasons. One is that if they have, say, 3 ERCs associated with their home, if they go down to 1, it goes against this philosophy of the money in the base is our stable revenue. The other thing it does is it leads to inaccurate data as far as usage per ERC goes, and in the context of conservation and understanding what our gallon per capita day is and things like that, it just starts to throw all that out of whack. So we got rid of that. And then there were a couple fees missing from the document at the last meeting, and then just some minor clarifications were added. That covers administrative and rules and regs. The last policy that was added into the agenda this week as part of an agenda amendment was the personnel policies. Dave can give us a quick update on this, but House Bill 163, I believe it is, goes into effect on July 1st, and it talks about personal use of public-owned property. And specifically, the county put together a personal use policy related, really kind of focused on devices, right? And electronics, computers, laptops, iPads, mm-hmm. things like that. I would like the board's approval essentially for us to incorporate that county policy into ours. I need to work with Jamie and Helen from Dave's office to understand exactly how that fits in and remove other duplicates, but that's the one piece that we don't have to put in front of you today because we just got it from Dave last Friday, I believe.
And what it deals with is when employees get district-owned property, to what extent can they use district-owned property for personal use? And what the Utah legislature said for the first time is we're going to define what that acceptable personal use is. And that acceptable personal use is incidental use. And they defined incidental use meaning as long as the value to the district in this case is substantially greater than any kind of personal use that the employee is using it, then that's incidental. But as a part of all that, the legislature said each jurisdiction needs to formulate a policy that's consistent with this and put it into their policies. while our personnel policies and your personnel policies kind of talk about incidental use, it really doesn't discuss it in any great detail. And so the purpose of these policies is to adopt the state statute definition and say that's incidental use. It also contains a footnote, just as kind of a reminder, that there's something else that's different than incidental use that's called de minimis use. And de minimis use is an IRS term of art. And de minimis use means that if the employee is using publicly provided property for personal use and it's de minimis, then it's not considered taxable income to that employee. But if it's more than de minimis use, then it is taxable and you get a 1099. So, and de minimis use has a different definition than what the legislature defined incidental use as. And I think that's what's caused some confusion. Because you can have incidental use, but that incidental use may be more than de minimis use, and the employee will be taxed on it. So there was a team management meeting with the county manager where this was kind of discussed, and I think it caused some concerns because if you've got district-provided cell phones, can they use it for personal use, and how much can they do that without it becoming a taxable fringe benefit? And luckily in this case, the incidental use definition and the de minimis for the IRS are actually the same. It's the only one where they're the same, just with cell phones. And all they say is as long as the primary use of the cell phone is for work-related, then it doesn't matter on personal use. But the de minimis standards do talk about things like copiers, printers, computers, and the de minimis use there, they specify as 15% is de minimis use for personal use. So, and that's different than the incidental use definition. So there are those kinds of things. The reason why it's important to define incidental use, because under the state statute now, if you have an employee that is using it more than incidental use, and it's not specifically authorized for more than incidental personal use as a fringe benefit, then that's a third degree felony. And they and they put that in because of what happened with the Unified Fire Authority in Salt Lake, where the Unified Fire Authority was basically buying Xboxes and other things for their senior staff. And when they tried to prosecute them, the statute was vague because it never defined incidental use. And so as a result of that, that's what we've, you know, it's when all you've got is a hammer, everything's a nail. And so that's what they did. We said at the time, and this is just, and it takes effect July the 1st, what we said is you're sweeping up a lot of things and a lot of employees into this because you're mad at what happened in the Unified Fire Authority. Notwithstanding, that's what happened. That's the reason why we need to adopt the policy for incidental use. It's different than de minimis because there's a different penalty. If it's de minimis use and you blow through de minimis use, you owe more taxes. You're not going to go to jail. you're going to have to pay an IRS penalty and interest. But if you blow through incidental use, then yeah, according to the legislature, you could go to jail. So that's the reason why those two are separate. Anyway, that's probably more than you want to know.
There were two.
Do you have any exposure?
In general, no. It's a training opportunity. I shouldn't say no. I mean, yeah, the employees do have exposure. It's a training opportunity for the employees that they understand these terms. They understand what incidental use is, and they understand the 15% rule on de minimis use for anything outside of a cell phone. A lot of the, you know, a lot of our operators, for instance, have iPads to be able to log into the SCADA system and things like that. You know, they're not to be family devices when they're not at work, things like that. So.
What about automobiles?
David, we've talked a little bit about there. We feel as though our vehicle policy has us covered there. It specifically talks about de minimis use. There were two questions, a couple of related questions that came up today in a staff meeting, and we'll touch on that. I'll try to keep it to a minimum. One was, there's this concept of privacy. Essentially, Dave and I and Lisa have talked about this, that any you know, cell phone, any device that's given to an employee is technically district property, whether that device costs any money or not. And I asked the specific question of, if an employee receives a cell phone from the district cell phone plan that comes at zero cost to the district, it's just a free cell phone, is that district property? And Dave's answer was yes, that is district property. Everything on that cell phone, there should be no expectation of privacy for anything on that cell phone. If that employee were to go out and purchase their own cell phone and either be a part of the district cell phone plan, meaning their phone line is attached to the plan, or get reimbursed from the district for their plan, that device is then not district property, and the only thing that is district property is just the content related to the district. So there is an expectation of privacy for that device for all areas outside of district use and material. And that's the way I understood it.
Yep.
And one of the questions that came up today is, again, even though it was no cost to the district, that can't be considered, say, a fringe benefit, basically, to the employees, that the district could provide a free cell phone to an employee, or if the employee wants to pay for the upgrade for some fancier phone, that isn't considered, that couldn't be considered a fringe benefit, thereby the employee owns it.
Yeah, because the only reason why they're getting the cell phone is because of the district. It is the district that's getting the free phones, and then it's giving it to the employee for purposes of district business. So,
what if the employee takes that phone and puts it on their own plan? So you're paying for the usage, it's in your family plan, the district reimburses you for a portion of that service cost that you're paying, and the phone is under your name in your plan.
But you got the phone from the district.
I got the phone from the That's kind of murky.
It's like a piece of clothing. It's a benefit. We want you to be able to have, we want to have access to you, but I don't want to have all my stuff all over.
I would say that the way to deal that with that is you then treat it as a fringe benefit.
Yeah.
And you tax them on it.
Yeah.
Well, in the world where there is no free lunch, just because you're getting a free phone, you're paying something somewhere in rates or usage fees or something that induces the provider to give you phones, right?
Right,
and so I think in the old days in the cellular business, you basically gave away the phone to sell the service, okay? Mm-hmm. That model changed a long time ago, but you know, it's still paid, you know, in many cases paid as you go.
From a general standpoint, the government contracts on the cell phone plans and the phones are much better than going out and trying to get your own.
Oh, I would yeah.
But even if it's a private phone, you own it yourself, you've got it on your own plan, but if you're using it for district business and only there's a legal action, anything on that phone.
No, only the content that pertains to the district. What we would do in that case is if there was a lawsuit and they wanted your cell phone to get off district-oriented business, we would get a protective order from the court
that would basically appoint a special master who doesn't work for any of the litigation parties to take the cell phone and only search it for specific things on district business. And in camera, those things could only be seen by the judge. And then once the judge approved them and said, hey, this is just district business, then they would send it to the parties.
Okay.
So, I mean, there is a process. We have done that before in litigation.
You did that with our computers, Dave.
Yeah.
The second question related to back to the privacy question. My interpretation of our discussion was that the privacy issue is related to the hardware. If you go out and buy your own hardware, you can assign it to the district plan, you can assign it to your own plan and get reimbursed by the district. Everything on that device is your privacy, except for that which is district business.
Correct.
Because our plan is probably cheaper than a personal plan. Like, we probably get a group discount because we have so many plans.
Yeah, it's like $55 a line is what it is for unlimited data and everything. You know, Doug asked the question, that doesn't make any sense. That basically it should be the plan itself that is hardware doesn't drive the privacy response, it's the plan itself that should drive it. So said another way, that if you're on the district plan, you should have no expectation of privacy, regardless of the hardware. And if you're on your own plan, you should have expectation of privacy.
Everything now is stored in the cloud. I mean, they pretty much can get everything off your phone, without even getting your phone.
What are your
thoughts? It's technically, I mean, we're talking about this. The plan is a service, not a property right. And we're talking, when we talk about privacy, we're talking about privacy, right, on property. On property that you own or the district owns, a service plan is not a property right. And that's the reason why the privacy things go with the device, go with the property, go with the content that's on the cloud, but does not follow the service.
Okay.
Well, but Chris can still log in and see everybody I'm texting. Just
right, we'll talk more about it. Yeah. We're moving on. We'll talk more on fringe benefits and taxing another time.
But we're okay to incorporate that policy. Do we need a recommendation?
Yes, we do need a recommendation to the County Council for approval of the updated personnel policy, rules and regulations, and administrative policies.
And to incorporate the personal use policy in
the rules. I have a motion to that effect.
So moved.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Motion approved.
All right, next up, item 10 is the update on community water. I think Marty and Brian have just brief updates from their respective departments.
So we've been replacing a bunch of meters from the high use meters. That's what our focus has been on. We're going to work into the residential stuff down the road here. We had our sanitary survey yesterday from the state. That went pretty good, but they dinged us for a few things. But the things they dinged us on are part of what we're going to fix on the wells and stuff like that. So we're going to do that anyway.
The sanitary survey was just on the community water.
Yeah, that was, by the way. Here's your survey.
It had been scheduled prior to us acquiring that. So.
Yeah, so it's interesting. We're just plugging along. We've been kind of working on some hydrants over there, you know, working through them and painting them and making them look nice. And we're digging up a big irrigation connection to try to put a master meter in right now. That's taking some time, so that's kind of the focus right now. Marty's going to be reading some meters Monday. So I'll be the first meter read. Yep.
We got the end reads from the community water, so we're going to be getting the beginning reads. We've been incorporating those customers into our billing system, which is been very complicated, and it's been awesome because we needed to have help from finance, which has been totally helping us. Steve's been great because there's so many complicated one-offs, you know, that to our system that we haven't seen before. All these master meters, funky irrigation meters, all these. So it's been a challenge, but I think we're really close, and we're real excited to get these guys meter reads on Monday and see kind of what.
Are they on manual reads?
They will be, with the exception of the ones we've changed out. A lot of these will be specially built vaults because of the size of these meters. So, and they're meters that we don't necessarily have on hand that we're ordering. So we've got a few of those things coming too. But we will be able to read all of the big usage meters with the exception of the homes and the townhomes, which are very small. They're not full-time residents, or they were in the winter, but not now. So those will change out over time. We have to get inside, they're all inside. So all the outside meters we're going to either replace or we're reading. So I think we'll have a pretty good handle on it. Yeah.
On the management side, there were a couple outstanding agreements. As you may remember, there was the Summit Water Interconnect that we're trying to have replaced near the Grand Summit. I was signing that agreement just here with Dave tonight. So we're pretty much there on that one, just getting signatures. The other one was the surplus water agreement to provide water to the lodges on the mountain. We haven't heard a word about that. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else, Dave?
Larry White, who was the CEO of TCSC, is leaving, or has now left TCSC. So it looks like TCFC, just like Vail, you had to go to New York. Now with TCFC, you have to go to Toronto. So it's good that we got this result now, because it's probably going to be difficult in the future to get deals done with TCFC or there. So I'm not sure where this surplus agreement's going to go with the lodges, because Summit Water's not planning to serve them, and we're not planning to serve them without an agreement. So Vail may be surprised that there's no water to their lodges that are on the mountain.
And there's also a nuance where the system that is above our point of connection is its own water system now, because we wouldn't take responsibility for any of that infrastructure. And based on what we understand with the Division of Drinking Water, there hasn't been any movement on getting the paperwork and things dialed in for that system.
Is that TCFC too?
Yes.
So there are a lot of...
So we're supplying water to it, we have no maintenance responsibility.
Correct. It's just like the meter on the edge of your property. We're providing water to the meter. We don't own the vault that the meter's in. We don't have any responsibility or anything else. So that's the community water update.
So why don't we skip impact fee for a second? Let's do the other things.
Okay. Dave, do you want to talk about 7-Eleven?
Yeah, I mean, in 7-Eleven. And we have a recommendation on the 7-Eleven was supposed to be part of the community water annexation, and for reasons nobody seems to know, when TCFC and Community Water made the petition to the county to annex in the Mountain Regional, they didn't include the 7-Eleven block.
It was on the map,
though. So, yeah, it was on the map.
But it was the lot number.
It was the lot number.
I thought it maybe was one by your office.
No, this is the one in the canyon.
This is the 7-Eleven canyon. So, when Scott told me that there might be a problem, we kind of went to ground on it and found out that for whatever reason, it inadvertently hadn't been included. TCFC informed the 7-Eleven owner, who was somewhat chagrined over it because he wouldn't be getting, you know, once this happened, he wouldn't be getting water. It takes a month even for a voluntary annexation. So what happened is at closing, TCFC signed a temporary water agreement with Mountain Regional to temporarily provide water to the 7-Eleven. Well, the 7-Eleven owner got a petition into us to annex and also signed a temporary water agreement to pay for the water until he's annexed in. So what you have in front of you is the petition to annex, and you need to make a recommendation to the county council to annex it in, and then at the next county council meeting,
Wednesday,
it'll be on their agenda, and we'll get this finished.
So who actually owns the plot?
There's a gentleman that owns a few of them.
He thought that they left him off because he didn't like the TCFC guy in the first place. I think he just left me off.
He was very pleasant.
Very nice to work with.
So,
so he got a petition like the next day. He was really hopeful.
We have a motion to approve, recommend the annexation to the county council.
Yeah, I move that we recommend to the county council the annexation of the 7-Eleven.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Next on the list is
there any other properties like that?
Excuse me?
Is there any other ones like that? Or just
not that we're aware of.
I've been very carefully going through because we use the parcel numbers, you know, for our billing system, and that was the only one I found.
When will folks get their first bill?
I think I'm leaving a vacation. It's July. It'll be the first week in July, so it'll be
more than their prior bills.
A lot more.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, I imagine that.
It'll be good. Well, along with kindness, they, you know, and they've been for so long that they'll get used to it. The first few months are always rough. It'll be fine.
Yep.
Next up is the two job descriptions we spoke about earlier, the Chief Technical Officer and the GPS-GIS job. GPS-GIS Administrator position. I would like to ask for the board's approval of those amended job descriptions.
I make a motion to approve.
Sorry.
Oh yeah, I'll second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Okay. Do you want to go through my comments, Bob, and then circle back for impact fees?
However you want to.
Let's just do it, get everything else done. We talked about the Red Hawk easement. Somewhat connected is we had a open bid process for two waterline improvements. The bid opening was this week. One of those improvements was the Glenwild to Red Hawk improvement. The other improvement is up in Stagecoach. We have a few hundred feet of water line that we need to put in to serve a connection that was never placed when the system was put in. That property owner is trying to sell the property and somehow realized that they didn't have a connection. We found out about this again last year. We worked through the easement process last year with the neighbor. Got everything dialed in, we're ready to put the water line in. When we opened the bids this week, the engineer's estimate for total cost, including 15% contingency, was about $205,000 bid. So we held the bid process. We got one contractor that came in. His price was $370,000+ for the project. So, what we would like to do is reject the bid. And I need to understand from Dave what the nuances of that are. From a rejection standpoint, the reasoning is that although it was a competitive process, we only got one response. I don't see that as being competitive pricing. The pricing is far exceeds the budgetary numbers, and I expect that we're going to see a change in scope related to this water line that's got to go up the service road, likely, although that's not defined yet. And finally, our engineer's recommendation was to reject it for those reasons, and also based on bad experience with this particular contractor.
And you can do that, you just have to send a letter to them saying you're rejecting all bids.
And then,
where is this line running? Is it running up Benton Road?
Nope, so there's two segments. One is in Stagecoach.
Totally within Stagecoach.
Yep, and then the other segment is the segment we talked about to bring the improved pressure down to Glen Isle. We've been bidding that in parallel, just trying to get things moving.
Got it.
With respect to rebidding the project, what are our requirements?
Just go out and rebid the same you did the first time.
So we don't have to change the scope, we don't have to...
Can you preclude that individual or company?
No, you can't. Unless you can't debar somebody from bidding.
Okay.
Unless you go through a process. So they can bid again, it's just... You know,
oh, so it was open. Anyone could bid on. Okay.
Yeah.
It wasn't, you selected three.
What we will do differently is have improved communication with the contractors we've worked with in the past to understand workloads and scheduling and try to provide ample time to respond. I think we had a pretty short response time because we were trying to get this going, to try to get more inputs to the process.
Did you previously have discussions with the contractor and the best and final offer?
So interesting you bring that up. Darren emailed me today and said and let the contractor know that he was far out of bounds with respect to what the budget was. And he asked about doing another review, value engineering the project. And Darren, he said a couple things. One was his understanding of the rules to that, to change his pricing, was that his scope was going to have to change. And given the fact that the job is so simple, it's just two waterline segments, he didn't see how he was going to be able to do that. And his second concern was just, again, back to bad experience and gut feel that was not a great way to proceed. But you bring up a good point, Tim, and a good question. I mean, what is our flexibility there?
Do you have complete discretion whether you want to go with final offers or you want to pull the plug and basically reject all bids?
It probably
did. It always with a scope change. There's probably two things are going to happen. You're going to get a bid from that person again for about the same amount, but they won't submit the bid. There's a myriad other things, but what's changed?
If we go back with best and final, I mean, it's still up to our discretion to reject all bids. It's probably hard to do that.
You always have that choice.
We also, there's in our procurement that if they're within 5% of our budget, we can go in and talk to the low bidder if they're within 5% to see if they can get it within the budget. In our procurement policy, there's kind of a little caveat.
What if they're 80% off?
Then we just reject it.
I'll go back and ask best and final. And we'll go from there.
We can still reject
it.
What's that?
You don't have a lot of leverage.
Is that a good use of time though, if it's that far out and we can't change scope? It sounds like it's more promising to potentially cash in on some of these other entities that we've worked with and just understanding their workload and guaranteeing they'll bid this time.
I have comments that, you know, some of these guys just didn't have enough time to deal with it.
Yeah.
So I'm on vacation, missed the deadline, so...
You deal with the response, not the project.
Yeah, the
response.
Yeah, so I mean, if we have a good indication somebody else is going to bid, I would propose just moving to that option. Just rebid, reject, and go ahead.
you guys are busy enough as is.
I'll chat with Darren tomorrow. We'll come up with a plan.
Good.
I continue to have a hard time getting a meeting nailed down with the council. Bob and I talked quite a bit over the last month. Part of it is our own schedules. You know, to be quite honest, you know, Bob's going to be out of town until August. Mike was difficult to get in touch with. And if we're serious about getting a meeting with the council, I think we should do it in Bob's absence, because you're going to be gone until August, right?
Right.
Karen, I think it makes sense for you to be there if you're interested in being there, you're the finance chair, and there's some overlapping expertise there, and one of the primary components of the conversation is what our future rate looks like to Weber Basin and ultimately to Summit Water for wholesale water. So before you leave tonight, let's talk about time frames that might work for you, and then I'll try to pin Mike down next week and see if we've got some overlap. I've promised to give Annette, the administrative assistant for the council, times that will work for us so that she can go and sort that out with them. So we went back and forth for a couple weeks and weren't successful. So next up is, there's potential that I am going to get an open seat on the Division of Drinking Water Board. I submitted an application a few months ago now for the open slot for the small system seat. The governor has approved that recommendation, so it's just up for Senate confirmation. We thought that was going to happen yesterday. It's going to be on the schedule for August 21st. So we'll see if they confirm that appointment.
Anything we can do to aid that effort? Or is it just kind of a...
Have they already had the confirmation hearing?
No. Nope.
So they're going to have a confirmation hearing in August?
Yes, correct. So there was a mix-up. I went down to the Capitol yesterday. They did do it yesterday.
That's pretty exciting.
I'm very excited.
This is a big deal.
This is a really big deal.
Yeah. A big memory. Yeah, I'm happy to write my state senator. I write it frequently. I never yet had a response.
It's in the Senate's hands, so that's if there's anything you can do, that's probably the only thing you can do at this point.
Right.
That I'm aware of. So anyway, that's that. And finally, the Intermountain Section Conference for AWWA is in Sun Valley in October, the 9th through 11th, I believe it is.
Yes.
And if any of the board is interested in attending, just let us know. We can get you registered and get rooms.
It's in Sun Valley?
It's the American Water Works Association Intermountain Section Conference.
October 19th.
So it's...
sounds like a blast.
it's a water conference. In a pretty place.
When they had, down at the U 2 years ago, it was very useful, I thought.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's anything like that.
Yeah. So.
In September.
October
Sun Valley, that's not bad.
We can send out the link. We'll send out the link, and if you're interested, just let Marty know.
Who's going from our team?
I'm going. I think, Lisa, you were planning on going. Okay. So, a couple of us. The registration just opened, so.
Good.
All right, impact fees. Final item on the agenda, back to number 11, is our impact fee facility plan. We are going to attempt to run through the key points of the document to give you a little bit of background and understanding of what's included. And then from a scheduling standpoint, our next board meeting, July the 11th, we'd like to present tonight,
get your feedback. We'll incorporate changes. Our next board meeting, July 11th, we'd like your recommendation for approval to the council. So that's how things are shaping up.
Chris, do you want to just bring up the other hook and you already got it? Yeah, there's the schedule. We can skip that, cover the main bases. So basically, Doug is the main author of this document. I thank Doug for all his hard work. The document begins just with a bunch of background information. The first area of, I think, kind of important content is what we consider to be the level of service. And it's important to understand on impact fees, there's four portions of the fee. It's the water right portion, the water source portion, storage, and distribution. So when we talk about level of service, what we're talking about is essentially the unit demand for each of those portions for a given residence. You can think of it as a customer's impact or its allocation of each of those categories. When we calculated the level of service in this fee study, we looked at usage from the years 2016 through 18, and we got a sense of what does the average home use from a right, source, storage, and distribution perspective. Source and right are calculated directly from that usage data. And then storage,
like page 14 would be good.
And then storage was a blended analysis of both looking at state standards and what our peak day supply is for a given residence. And then the distribution component is associated with essentially the peak hourly or more or less the peak instantaneous demand for a given residence. Later in the document, when Doug walks through the specifics of how we calculate the fee for that component, it relates back to storage. How much water is the storage reservoir going to provide to that customer? So the next component, Chris, can scroll down a little more, talk about growth. With respect to growth, what we did is we looked at, Doug, correct me if I'm wrong, this is a 10-year average that we looked at to come up with 124 ERCs per year. And then, you can see here the 2019 estimate shows that 124, and then if we go to the next table down, you'll find we're just incrementing our total number of ERCs on our system by 124 per year, giving a total over our future 10-year outlook of 1,240 ERCs. The next important component is the project list.
Scott, I have a question on ERCs.
Mm-hmm.
Could we possibly be overestimating how much water we need per ERC, given like a condominium / hotel room? It might have the minimum ERC, but might not use the minimum amount of water. And that some larger properties might also be the same way. They have a lot of ERCs based on, you know, big square footage that's never occupied kind of thing. And that in the aggregate, you know, by always sort of having that we overestimate the total requirement, you know, it's like you always take the most conservative assumption on everything, you end up way over on the far side of what you need.
One of the things that I can help on that, it's a little different from impact fees compared to rates. Impact fees are assessed based on what you could use. It has nothing to do with it's kind of like a power company charges their peak demand based on the peak minute. It
because that's what they have to size all their infrastructures to, that minute of the month. They don't care what the rest of, and the impact fees are kind of the same way. It's what your property and irrigation was designed for, assuming you were there at a peak time of the year.
Right.
Because if you were there one day of July, our water system would be sized for that day.
Right.
And you could be absent the rest of the year. You know, so it's just kind of a little different.
I think otherwise you can just take the total gathering and divide it by the ERCs and kind of come up with something other than 800, right? It's probably going to, you're saying it's most likely less.
Yeah, now what happens with Mountain Regional compared to everyone else who's doing this, our ERCs, our level of service drops over time just because of our rates and our conservation, our pressure to conserve, and we incentivize that with really high rates. So the rates have pushed our level of service down where other water systems would have a higher level of service. If that makes sense.
In order to arrive, if we just go back up, Chris, to the summary of the level of service for right source.
It's like a state average for a water right would be 3/4 of an acre foot.
Right.
Ours is 50% less than that.
Well,
but fifth down to 0.5, and a lot of that is because ERCs use less water, and a lot of it because some of them aren't occupied all the time.
Right.
So it does drive the level of service down, and it may keep dropping in the future.
So you can talk to the specifics here, but I mean, the water right and water source, these numbers are calculated directly from water use data, you know, over those 3-year periods. You know, to Tim's point, the water right is just the volumetric usage, so it is quite simply just the total water used divided by the number of ERCs, right? The water source, that gets a little trickier where we have to look at the peak month usage, and then there's industry standard factors that you apply to calculate the peak day and to peak instantaneous usage.
We get to the peak day on a source because the storage and the distribution system take care of the instantaneous. On a water source, we're just trying to get you to the peak day.
There's very small safety factors that were applied based on just a few percentage points, if I remember right, Doug, on the water right, thinking about drought response and things like that, and then also on the water source. This ties directly to our previous concurrency rating, which is through Summit County.
And that rating dropped slowly, too, because of our... The concurrency program has shown that our per ERC source rating is dropping slowly, and they give us a credit for that. So we were able to serve more customers with a lower level of service rating. So
any other questions on that, Bob? We can jump to the project list.
No, that's fine.
Okay.
That's fine.
So we sat down as a team many times over the last at least a year to come up with what we believed were projects that had a likelihood of being built over the next 10 years. With all of these studies, things change over a 10-year period. Some of these things may or may not be built. If they are not built, it's not... I don't want to say it's not a big deal, but we're not penalized. The money that was brought in just has to be spent within 6 years on an impact fee eligible project or on debt.
Given the debt that we have, that's never been a problem. So we can prepay debt with any of the money that comes in from impact fees.
This is the project list we came up with. There's four source projects. I will say that the share of the regionalization and interconnection projects, that's in here just for tracking purposes. The regional interconnects between us, Summit Water, and Park City, we expect to only use those from an emergency water perspective until many, many years from now. When Mountain Regional needs additional source, we will evaluate the cost of purchasing wholesale water from one of the master agreement partners against an own internal project of, say, additional water through the Lost Canyon system and then additional treatment capacity and things like that. There's one storage project that we expect. We need to replace the Summit Park Tank 1. We're hopeful to be able to do that next year, which means IRS start working on property, getting easements and things now. And then the remaining projects are in distribution. The EPA pipeline is what we just completed, but the money spent to put that project in becomes eligible for reimbursement based on the capacity that our future growth will utilize in that project. Depending upon what Promontory does in South Point, we expect to potentially upsize the main line through there down to Browns Canyon for potential future source development or growth if growth happens down there. Willow Creek Old Ranch, this is what this does. You've heard about this project before. What this does is essentially removes all of the Willow Creek demands from the White Pine Tank. The White Pine Tank is a tank that serves the Lower Canyons area and frees up the ability to connect to that tank, additional connections if we need them. Old Ranch Booster Station, we're evaluating whether or not we need additional surge protection as more demand, more water flows through that facility. Both the Glenwild and the Red Hawk pump stations need to be upgraded with respect to the amount of water they can move to serve future demands. And then finally, there's a Lower Silver Creek pipeline that we've often talked about to bring additional water out of the Lower Promontory and Silver Creek area over to essentially over to Bittner Road and serving, you know, the North Ridge into the west. Currently, we only have one conveyance path to move water through the entire trailside area, and that's our large transmission line that really ultimately heads down Old Ranch Road. So this last project would serve both a small need for growth and then also redundancy. With respect, when I say redundancy is not impact the eligible. We calculated the specific portion that would be used for future growth.
So, Scott, I have a couple quick questions.
Sure.
Reading through the document, I came away a little bit confused what our deal is with Promontory versus the rest of our retail customers. And it's like they participate in some aspects of the impact fee, but not in others. So it's kind of like you have to cleave everything that's Promontory projects from another area project, and each gets its own impact fee, so to speak.
Yes.
So like that EPA thing you were talking about, yeah. Depending upon what the Promontory does about South Point, is that then in the Promontory impact bucket, or is it a general?
So in general, the reason that Promontory has their own, their own impact fee, is related to the fact that they own their own water right allocation.
Yeah, I got all that.
Yeah.
But so is it almost, what I'm not appreciating is we almost have like two systems, each with its own calculations, as we go forward.
What we did is, and Doug, you can talk to the specifics of this, we essentially evaluated projects that
if projects benefited the promontory community, then they would, Doug has a checkbox that goes to yes in the spreadsheet that then it, you know,
right,
rolls up those costs.
Yep.
So anything in really, it's the lower promontory area that has connection to our core Atkinson zone, the whole district. Any projects really that kind of land in that Atkinson zone that have the ability to serve promontory is where the checkboxes came in.
This is like, if you look at the source, here's all Lost Canyon projects and right, the subtotal. So everything in this area, $7.5 million worth, this is what promontory paid for already. Right. And is being funded through assessment bonds and other cash contributions that they made a long time ago. So we can't, and they're paying also, like he said, their water, annual water rights fees. So what we did on this, the only source they get charged for is 15B and 15C, and we had an agreement with Rich clear back in the beginning that source they would pay a share of as a backup source, and in fact that was the source the promontory used for their first few years for everything, for the golf, for the dive course. And so we felt like everyone kind of came together and said, well, that's a valuable source to them in case something goes wrong with us. And so it is, those 15B and 15C is picked out, and their own fee is calculated for that. It's, and this has been done since the very beginning.
I was involved in a lot of that back in the day, but I mean it was very specific because we had two bonds issued and we paid for most of the pipeline,
right,
and we paid for
I just want to make sure
even
the recent storage that was put in a few years ago. It was for their south point stuff.
So well, how much of the Lost Canyon water goes to promontory and how much goes elsewhere?
I mean, we know the exact 2,400 acre feet goes to promontory, 2,900 acre feet goes to Park City, and 1,180 acre feet comes to us. The last comment I had on the project list is all the cost estimates. Our engineers' estimates from Aqua.
Right.
So they could be 50%.
They could be even 80% though.
Yeah.
We are using.
I get that, you know, looking 10 years out is kind of a tough task, but it does seem like things are sort of bunched towards the front end.
They are. That's correct. That's absolutely correct.
We've talked about, and Dave has mentioned, one of the secrets, because we've got this kind of figured out so well now and tied to growth figures, which is that you just update this more often. You look at it every year if you want it and readjust those things.
The county does, right, Dave? The Public Works Department does?
I mean, we try to have a complete redo every 5 years.
But one of the things that, I mean, I think assuming that the underlying facts more or less support it, we do want certain stability in the impact fees. We don't want somebody who starts today saying, you know, twice what somebody who starts next year is paying impact fees. Right?
I think impact fees move around. The more often that you do them, the more gradual things are, as opposed to, you know, if you stretch it out to 5 years every time, you're gonna get bigger differences.
Right.
That same difference is gonna be experienced over that 5-year period, but you're gonna increment it, obviously.
Right.
So
thing that may trigger an update is an unknown big future project development that you weren't, that we didn't see on this.
Right.
And if there was like a 800 home development going in or big,
yeah,
you might go, man, we got to relook at this.
Yeah, the Browns Canyon, come, you know, something goes over there with, you know, a couple thousand units and source and whatever else. And so.
Yeah, it's right. The county pace parcel. You know, nobody knows what's going to happen with that either.
So you mean?
So the county's pace parcel, right there by the state roadhouse, you know, the county's going to subdivide that and sell some of it off.
Gilmore.
Oh, not Gilmore. Gilmore, sorry. Gilmore parcel.
Yeah. We don't know anything. There's a potential development there that we don't know anything about.
All right, next on my list is to have Doug walk through one of these tables, just to give you a sense of what's in it and answer any questions.
And so this is just the source one. The table, and I can email you the spreadsheet if you. That might be an easier way to.
It'd be helpful.
I think that would be a lot easier because, you know, it's sideways.
And Doug, if I could butt in for 1 second, that so after the projects, really the document breaks up into you know, more or less duplicate sections. The same analysis is gone through for each of those four components. So that's why I say I'd like Doug to walk through one of them, so you get a sense of what's in there, and really the same methodology kind of trickles throughout those four sections.
Yes. So I just am doing the source because it's the more complicated. It's got other sources of money like assessments, bonds, and things. So here's the existing projects. The Lost Canyon is made up of a bunch of components. They're subtotal. There's cash that Mountain Regional contributed. There's promontories. We show the date that they were completed, the total project, which bond issue funded those. And so now it's, so we take cash assessment. So to get to the bond cost, we take the project cost less all of these. What's left over is what we bonded for. If that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And then accounting adjusts each bond issue by a debt service factor. Bonds are kind of, you can't just do an amortization thing because bonds are strange. They have different coupons, different years. So they look at what the total principal and interest is that each bond and come up with just a factor that we multiply it by. So now we have the total debt service cost, which is bond cost times that factor. And then we take the total cash, this plus the bonds is the only part we can go after for impact fees to help recover. These are not eligible. So this becomes the number now that we work with. The same thing is done on future projects, except we're taking the engineer's estimate, add in inflation at 5% a year, and coming up with a estimated cost based on the completion year. And we aren't planning on bonding for any of those projects. So they're all shown as cash, and that just carries over to column M. Then what we do is we look at, have to eliminate the part of the project is already, customers have already paid for, or is servicing, like Scott talked about, the Summit Park tank. A big part of that tank is going to replace an old one, and so we can't use impact fees to fix a problem. It can only be used for new growth. So deduct that out. So the percent to existing demands is based on what the percent was last in the 2013 one. We add the 19% growth we had since then. And on new projects, a lot of them are zero when it hit. But if you look at like the storage tank, 35% of that is being used to fix current
problems, so we can't use that. And then we calculate what is going to be used in the next 10 years, and that's based on for existing projects, it's based on our 10-year growth rate in ERCs. For new projects, Scott and Julie, that's based on modeling and their calculations. And the difference in those is the amount beyond 10 years that we can't do anything with. And over time, some projects, like this one right here, okay, we're consuming the rest of its capacity in the next 10 years. And so there'll be nothing. So as you progress, you're going to start to lose some capacity in the 10 years if you don't do anything. And that will start bringing impact fees down too, which is start to max out the capacity. So once we establish those percentages, we take the total capacity of the asset and we multiply it by that to come up with the existing capacity in GPM, the capacity available for the next 10 years that we can use, and the capacity beyond that. And so that takes the GPM capacity and allocates it based on those percentages. Water rights is based on acre feet. Storage is based on gallons. And then we do the same thing with the cost. We now multiply that $77.4 million by these percentages, and now we have the cost in the 10-year period. And we do the same thing for the future. And we add, so in capacity, we have 738 GPM of existing, 240 of future, gives us 978. We're only looking at this 10-year window. The level of service is 0.79. We divide 978 by 0.79, and that gives us the 1238. And as a check, 1240 is the magic number we want to get to in ERCs.
So for each of these, we used growth as our checks and balances, essentially. So 1,240 ERCs is what we expect to see at the end of 10 years, yeah. And we're using that as our target.
Yeah, so I used up that 1,240 here. So, and then we do the same thing with the money, with the cost, I mean. We've got $1.5 million.
And you're adding 496.
Yeah, plus the 496 gives us the $2 million. So we carry that down. We're now going to divide it by the 1238, which is the capacity in ERCs. And now we have the impact fee per ERC of 1,694. And we do the same thing with promontory if it's political. I have to keep that number the same. I can't give promontory another denominator. It'll screw theirs up. And so that's kind of, it's, in the end, it's just a division problem. The one thing that is a little different, and some cities in that have tried to tackle this, the distribution system is really complicated. It's very hard to say your project is using so much of this pipe and so much of this pipe, because the modeling of the distribution system is so complex. So Scott said, we just take the capacity in ERCs of the storage system, and we're saying that that distribution system as it's presented delivers the level of service and distribution of that 1.44 peak hour or 2,000 gallons a minute of fire storage, leaving 20 PSI. The storage system will deliver that through the distribution system. It's just very, and that's why we carry down that storage number to calculate. And when we talked to Zions Bank, they thought that made a lot more sense than some of the others they worked on, because it's just not as straightforward on the distribution system. Everybody gets some benefit of pipes, but it's hard to we don't want to get into a business where we're color coding the water.
Yeah.
It goes to different people. If we do that, we end up how we were when we first did this in 2001. We had 11 different impact fees in different districts, and it just was too complicated.
Well, of course, we probably irritated half the people.
Well, and we've made probably some big mistakes too. Deciding which person gets which one, it was.
Yeah.
Where there was uncertainty, we tried to apply the same same assumptions across a number of projects. So we weren't cherry picking the expensive projects, right? You'll see when you look at this more closely that some of the percentages to 10-year growth are the same percentages for a number of projects. So that's where it's difficult to understand exactly how much growth is going to be attributed to a given project. An educated projection was done, and that same assumption was placed on a number of projects. So then we get in, so that same methodology applies to the tables for the four different categories of the impact fee, and then we get into the actual summary of the numbers here. So that top table is the summary of the number that we came up with. This is not the final number. This is where we're at today. There's a couple nuances that Zions Bank's working on that they needed to check on. We can put in the consulting fees into this, which would increase it ever so slightly. And then they're looking into a credit situation, essentially the question of do customers' rates, are they paying for some of this debt? Is there double dipping going on? They're helping us to look into that. But anyway, this is where we're at today. This is the top fee of $9,400 roughly. Our previous impact fee study or impact fees have been $10,500 roughly since the start of 2014. So they've gone down slightly as part of this analysis. My general just kind of sanity check on that for myself as well. In some of these cases, level of service is coming down. We're delivering a little bit less water per customer as a result of lower usage. This feels about right. The reality is there's so much more that goes into this. It has to do with the projects, the usage, and all these other factors. So the last point that I have is just that this establishes what the impact or connection fee is for a single family residence. It's equivalent to one ERC. The methodology for calculating the impact fees for those cases that aren't exactly one ERC remain the same as what we did before. Essentially, anything over 3,000 square feet, the impact fee is based on the square footage of the home. Doug is revamping those charts from the old data set.
Where does that data come from?
The usage per
home size.
It came from county records at the time, right? Home size.
It was based on we took county assessor square foot of buildings, and we took square foot of lots, and we're trying to figure out is there any correlation between those and water use. We found out lot size had no correlation. Initially, we thought lot size would be. We did see a correlation on homes, on square footage. And there's some charts in that thing. If you go to section 5 or 6,
right,
it kind of shows how that happens. I just need to update those a bit. It's not, but it shows that, when you get up to, what was it, 8,000?
8,000.
It really climbs more. You start to, and part of the reason we started to find is some of those homes had much bigger irrigation impacts. And so when they get to that size, we start going beyond the square, start to look at is there irrigation beyond an average? I mean, we were looking at irrigated yard space of an average ERC. It was just getting to be a lot of brain damage, but we started to see some patterns, and it worked.
So if I came in and said, you know, I need a connection, and here's what I'm feeling. Do you look at that individual? Do you look at, or do you take what the assessor said?
We take for all new connections, they have to provide their architectural plans with the living space.
And if it's over 8,000 square feet, the irrigated acreage.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Good. If you go by the square footage that's in the county database, it's all over the map. We did extensive look up in our area of what the county had for various people's options, and if you have a story and a half, part of it's living space, part of it's not, if you have a downstairs, part of it isn't, you know, it's all over the map. I don't know what you use as your standard.
It was the counties, because we didn't have anything else to go with.
Yeah. Right, I would agree.
Yeah.
We don't start building historical stuff.
So from the start of 2014, we've got every plan set that we looked at.
Yeah.
You know, so all that was based on true square footage.
It's based on gross square footage.
It is
a question.
It would be square footage net of of garages, decks, patios.
But utility rooms are included.
Yeah, unfinished space is included, you know, with the potential that you could finish it.
Right.
Okay. Some have some more, a lot of big deck and patio space.
Right.
And huge garages, we take that out.
And then the methodology for commercial uses will remain the same. That defers back to the Division of Drinking Water's use tables as far as, you know, number of ERCs related to different uses.
Yeah, that would be amazing.
My last job, we had a funny way of, we found what correlated the gas was how many pillows a house had. We counted pillows.
Including couch pillows?
Throw pillows.
Because it was in a resort area,
and
we found it was based on how many people could sleep in a home. What was it designed to sleep?
Yeah.
And pillow, so we had this big spreadsheet of pillows.
That's funny.
And it worked.
Are there any questions, comments, concerns about where we've started and where we're at?
Seems really thorough.
Yeah, super thorough.
Yeah, and the offer to share a spreadsheet would certainly help.
I'll say the spreadsheet. The difference in this one and past ones is we try to explain, it's a little more wordy, but we're trying to explain it in more detail so it will be more helpful in the future as these get changed. And I'm thinking several years down the road, we may want to go do another dump of the county data again and relook at it. But that was so much work last time we did it. I'm trying to not reinvent that one yet. We spent more time on that than
anything.
It was done in 2013.
Oh, it was 13, the last one.
Yeah, but it was just, that was the hardest part.
But since we got all the plans from 2014, we couldn't very well go back to a house that was built in 2010 and say, county record said it was 3,000, it was really 6, so you owe us more money?
Yeah, well, we'd have something to compare it to. We could see what the county showed. But I agree with you, the county could be wrong on some.
Well, a lot of this way they seem to interpret stuff. Yeah.
Well, they have a new assessor now, too, that's going to be more thorough, because we were wondering, too, if they're missing out on some tax revenue, you know, because their records are so odd.
We found in the process, Chris, we're kind of, I think, caught this, you caught this. We found a lot of property held by HOAs that is not assessed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
They have no tax ID numbers. Well, they're supposed to be assessed.
That's been hard because of the master meters. If people don't pay their bills, we have nothing to
win. We don't even find
tax ID. So, you know, we've been really digging into this significantly with Community Water.
Oh, yeah. Like, if you look at places like Pine Grove, they've got huge amounts of open land that are not assessed.
I apologize for the long agenda.
That's just is what it is sometimes. Thanks for your patience. Work through it.
Any other comments? All right,
I will email you all the spreadsheet.
Yeah, that would be great.